Web or home or in your car, listen to WHFR, Dearborn.
Ever have this conversation with yourself? Local news and alternative views. I know. You don't know. I know what I need to know. You don't know enough. I read news on the internet. You don't know local. I check into Facebook a lot. You don't know facts. I watch television news. You don't know in depth. I read the local newspapers. Better, but you still don't know background analysis, the real voices of the newsmakers. Then what should I do to really know local news and alternative views? You need to listen to the new WHFR Journal, broadcast live Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on WHFR 89.3 FM, or get their podcast from www.whfr.fm. So, now I'll know. Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students. The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say. For this time,
new ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.fm. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to WHFR@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
We really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click the donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon.
Our thinking originates, as always, at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is the nature of wilderness.
Well, Ken, as philosophers, we always like to start with a definition, and we are given a definition of wilderness by the 1964 Wilderness Act. Quote, wilderness is, the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man. Wilderness is that which, quote, retains its primeval character and influence without permanent improvement or human habitation, end quote.
Ken, you know, that's a cool definition. I like that definition. I really like that phrase, untrammeled by man. It's so poetic. It's inspiring. It's just like the wilderness itself, poetic and inspiring.
Yeah, but, you know, the problem is it's not very accurate. Now, take the Desolation Wilderness up near Lake Tahoe. That's a place I like to go hiking and often have. Mount Taluk rises above Lake Tahoe, and you can go up there, and there's alpine lakes, and if it's sunny, it's fun, and if it's rainy, it's pretty horrible. But whatever it is not untrammeled. It's got trails. It's got some signs. Until the year 2000, every spring when the lakes thawed, the U.S. Forest Service would fly planes over and drop trout into those lakes. Not exactly untrammeled.
So you're kind of saying it actually takes a lot of human effort to maintain this pristine, untrammeled wilderness. That does sound a little paradoxical, John.
Well, I think we get a paradox because we start with a confused concept, the concept of wilderness. It is confused, and confusion often leads to paradox.
You're telling me you don't like wilderness, dude?
I love the wilderness on a sunny day, and I'm all for preserving it. It's the concept of wilderness that I find troubling.
What's wrong with the concept of wilderness? A perfectly natural concept.
No, it's not a natural concept. It's a human invention, a social construction. It's a bunch of myths built on one another. It confuses our thinking. And it confuses our thinking when we're dealing with important issues like conservation and biodiversity. The wilderness itself ought to be preserved, but the concept of wilderness should just be junked.
I don't get it. Why would you say a thing like that? It seems like, again, a natural concept. Why would you say a thing like that?
Well, taken literally, the concept doesn't apply to anything at all. There's no place on Earth that's entirely untouched by the hand of man. I mean, even a place like the Desolation Wilderness was for millennia occupied in the summers by Native Americans. And nowadays, not even Antarctica or the depths of the Pacific is untrammeled, untouched by human beings.
You know, look, I'm going to concede something to you. I think there's surely a lot of mythologizing associated with the concept of the wild. But you know what, John? Not all myths are bad. I mean, sometimes myths encapsulate our deepest aspirations. Go back to the early days of America. In American folklore, the idea of a wilderness was associated with the idea of a boundless but once boundless but now disappearing frontier. And this was supposed to be a place that beckoned Americans to go and make themselves anew. A myth, but it's still a useful myth, even to this day, because partly to recapture this idea of the once bountiful frontier, we form national parks, forests, wilderness areas, and these are places where we can go for renewal and recreation. That seems like a good thing, so the myth played an important role.
Well, I'll struggle not to be reduced to tears by your speech. But, you know, the basic truth is the concept of wilderness distorts our relationship to nature. It assumes a dualism of humans and nature, as if humans are outside of nature. In reality, for better or worse, humans are a part of nature.
I'll concede humans are a part of nature, but I'm not sure what you think follows from that. What? A Manhattan skyscraper is as much a part of nature as a bird's nest in the wood? That doesn't seem to me like true. That seems like an odd thing to say. So we got to separate man from nature.
Well, no, I think we have to see that humans are a part of nature, and we have to see, well, how do they fit into nature? What concepts that apply to nature in general help us understand humans? And I think it's pretty clear what it is. We need to think of humans as an aggressive, non-native species that has impacted every conceivable ecosystem on Earth, mostly in a destructive way. If we really want to protect the rest of nature from us, we need to conceive ourselves rightly. We're pests.
We're the pest? Oh, come on, John, we're the pest?
Yes, we are the pest, and what we call wilderness is a place where pest control, keeping out the invasive human pest, has been successful, or at least more successful than elsewhere.
Jeepers, John, God, you're such a downer. You're squeezing all the romance out of the concept of wilderness. Look, I want a concept of wilderness that's beautiful and inspiring and poetic. That's what I want.
Yeah, but if we're going to get serious, Ken, about preserving wilderness, about preserving ecosystems and preserving species, we need a serious and sober understanding of what wilderness really is and not your mythological claptrap.
Okay, look, I'm not sure I agree with your concept of wilderness. Actually, I'm sure I don't agree with your concept. But, you know, I see that there's lots to talk about here. Can there be a concept of wilderness that actually applies to some stretches of the earth and not to others? And what's the right way to think about humankind's relationship to the rest of nature in the first place? Are we the pest, as you say, or are we the wise stewards, as I hope we can be?
We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to learn what happens when wilderness meets urban devastation. She files this report.
This is the story of a post-urban environment, a place where wilderness is anything but natural. It's about a square piece of land in the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans. This residential neighborhood with small houses and little lawns was ripped apart in 2005 by Hurricane Katrina.
There was sort of a monochromatic look of death, basically, from 6-7 feet, wherever the water line had been on the houses, downward.
Peter Yockey is an ornithologist in the geography department at the University of New Orleans. He recalls what happened to this piece of the lower Ninth Ward after the water receded.
Probably the most striking thing about it was, first of all, the complete lack of people. The second most impressive thing about it is the lack of color from the water line down. Everything was sort of a sepia and white, the sort of way you see in old photographs.
Yockey recalls a desolate landscape with splintered dead trees. It was here that he decided to track the recovery of bird populations. At first, there were no birds at all, but slowly they started to return. The following spring, weeds sprouted up. Exotic tree species like the Chinese tallow thrived and started taking over. Some urban birds like the European starling and rock pigeons came back. Then strange birds started showing up, like swamp sparrows. And birds of prey like American kestrels and red-tailed hawks. Yockey says the remarkable thing is that these birds showed up in great numbers.
One of the aspects of the natural invasion of the area had been this incursion of birds of prey, which seemed to me to be using the remnant rodent population, which of course is a leftover of the urban component. So that's an interesting juxtaposition of urban and natural, and in this case, the urban kind of feeding the natural.
Slowly, people returned, but just a fraction of the former population. Which raises the question, can land be reclaimed by nature, creating a natural ecosystem after it's been urbanized? Peter Yockey says the Lower Ninth Ward has been so reshaped since Bienville founded the city in 1718 that it will never revert to the red maple or bald cypress swamp it used to be.
But the question, you know, that's kind of being answered there is what would happen to urban land if you just took the houses off and left it alone? And of course, you've still got the gridwork of streets there. You've got the stone foundation still on the ground. But it's rapidly being reclaimed by secondary succession, as we say, in ecology, where you have weeds coming in and then small woody plants, and they develop into a forest eventually.
This urban-rural Frankenstein geography could go either way. Yockey says cities abandoned for economic reasons, like in parts of Michigan, are already receding back into the wilderness. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. it's interesting to see that the world doesn't just divide into urban and wilderness, but there's all sorts of things in between, including some very strange things like the Ninth Ward in New Orleans as it comes back from Katrina. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon.
And please welcome now our guest, Jay Odenbaugh. Jay's a professor of philosophy at Lewis and Clark College. He's author of many articles in the philosophy of biological science, including Advocacy and Environmental Ethics. Jay, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be here.
Jay, you're officially a philosopher of science, especially biology. That's how you were trained. But you've gotten very involved in issues about wilderness and biodiversity. How did that happen?
Well, I started as a philosophy undergrad, and I found myself mostly interested in philosophy of science. And so I figured to do philosophy of science, I needed to know some science. And so I thought about physics, and I had too much math, and chemistry was, well, it was chemistry. So I decided on biology, and what I found was I was most interested in ecology and evolution. And one of the first questions I was most interested in was, what's the relationship between humans and nature? Are we part of nature, or are we actually separate from nature? And so that was one of the beginning questions I was pursuing. I think wilderness is particularly interesting because when we think about wilderness, it raises that question and the uncomfortableness we have with those aspects of ourselves.
Well, the concept of wilderness, as we indicated in your introduction, has become a little bit of an issue in ecology and similar areas. Ken and I took different sides on that. What do you think? Is there a viable, unconfused concept of wilderness, or should we just give up the idea?
You know, I think I probably have to side with you, John. It seems to me that the notion of wilderness is confused. There's a couple of reasons I'd give. One which is that it seems that there's not a lot of wilderness left. And in fact, if you think about climate change, we're changing the temperature of the planet, we're turning the thermostat up. You know, if you think about our history, Native Americans use fire to clear forests.
Okay, there's not a lot of wilderness left, but people who want to preserve wilderness, there's something they want to preserve, the wilderness, or people who want to recover wilderness, like the New Orleans neighborhood, it sounds like it's maybe on the way to becoming a wilderness again. So maybe we could use it to restore this lost thing. Is the concept really confused, or is it just rare?
It's rare. I think maybe one way of articulating what we just saw or heard in the story is what matters is not wilderness, sort of nature untouched by us, but rather what I would call wildness, nature which acts in its own accord, sort of in its own way.
Well, for example, the rainforests are very important when we think about biodiversity and any hope of ecology being maintained around the world and even the amount of oxygen we have in the air. And so people think rainforests, those are wilderness, but they're not wilderness. They're heavily populated. I mean, not compared to New York City, but they've been populated for a long time. So one thing about the concept of wilderness is it sometimes leads to the idea that to preserve nature the way we want it, we need to remove the people. But those people are part of the nature that has been in rainforests forever.
I think that's right. I think, you know, the price we pay for sort of recreating wilderness is actually moving people out of their sort of native land. So if you think about, there's 7 billion people on the planet now, maybe there'll be 12 or 15 by the end of the century. The only way to recreate wilderness would actually be to unjustly remove them.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. We're talking about the nature of wilderness with philosopher of science extraordinaire, Jay Odenbaugh.
Are humans a part of nature, a good part, or basically just an invasive pest? An invasive species or the part of nature that gives value to the whole? What do you think?
Humans and nature, civilization and wilderness, along with questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Mother Nature, shiver at the bus stop. Hope she has as a cough drop, it gets cold. There's Mother Nature screaming at the golf course. We might have to use force, she can scold. There's Mother Nature sweating on our front porch. Hope she doesn't get scorched, it gets warm. When will she go home? When will she go home?
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about the nature of wilderness with Jay Odenbaugh from Lewis and Clark College.
What's your conception of wilderness? Does it make sense to talk about the intrinsic value of nature, or does value mean value for human beings and for their projects? If the rest of nature would be better without us, why don't we just eliminate ourselves? Or at least control ourselves? Or maybe we should just not worry about it. Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone.
So, Jay, I want to dig deeper into this question about the relationship between humans and nature, humans and the wilderness. Look, it's obvious that humans are part of nature in some sense, but that's not really how we tend to think of ourselves. We tend to think of our own interventions in, well, the rest of nature and the rest of the natural world as interventions from outside. And we don't think of any other creature on this planet in that way. Well, what's up with that?
I think that we are legitimately part of nature. I think this is one of the deep insights of Darwin, that we are natural beings in a natural world. I do think that we are different than non-human animals and plants, etc., but those are differences of degree and not of kind.
Differences of degree and not of kind. See that? So I kind of accept the intuition that we're part of nature, but the idea that it's a difference of degree and not of kind. Look, many creatures affect their environments. A bird builds a nest, a beaver builds a dam, you know, a monkey clears a path, takes the bananas off the tree, and we build skyscrapers. That's a really radically different kind of thing.
It is, it seems, but I think that Darwin was right. I mean, I think if you look at the classic ways that philosophers from Aristotle on have tried to distinguish the human from the non-human, rationality, language, culture, those all have fallen by the wayside.
And, you know, Caitlin's report is relevant here because we see even these great things that humans have constructed. Now, maybe the Ninth Ward of New Orleans isn't quite like Manhattan in terms of the monstrous nature of the things, but they give way to nature in maybe not in the short periods that human beings think of as relevant, but in the long periods. They give way, and yet they change it. So I think we are a part of nature, and the changes we make in nature and the things we leave behind are, as Ken says, similar to the things others do, and yet dissimilar. But then we have this other thing. We think about what we're doing, and we think about it using concepts. And if those concepts are no good, that thinking is going to probably make things worse rather than better. Is that an important difference?
It is. I think one of the fundamental differences, not a difference in kind, but one of the important differences is that we're moral agents. We understand our actions. We can foresee the consequences of our actions. We can praise and blame each other and hold each other responsible.
I'm willing to grant the insight. I'm a naturalist. I believe that human beings are natural creatures. I believe we're part of nature. And some people criticize the concept of wilderness because it presupposes this duality of man, humankind and nature. And they say that's a false presupposition. But I'm just not sure. Okay, suppose we clean up the concept and we don't have this duality. I'm not sure what follows, right? Because it seems to me, even if we are part of nature, we are such a distinctive part of nature that there's got to be some way to separate us from the rest of nature. I mean, there's us as natural beings, and then there's the rest of the natural world, and that's an important distinction. I don't know how to make it, but that's an. Don't you agree?
So let me put it this way. So I agree that humans have a distinctive impact on the natural world, largely harmful. But I don't think that's just because of the species that we are. I think it's because of how gluttonous and unthinking we've become.
Well, okay. So let me try out something else in you.
You're just trying to cheer us up.
In preparing for this show and some other things I read, I came across a new term in paleontology and geology. We're entering a new age, the Anthropocene age. That's the age in which everything on the planet is, as Gerard Manley Hopkins says, bleared, smeared with trade. It wears man's smudge and shares man's smell, nor can foot feel being shod, right? Because our impact is everywhere. And a whole geological age is being named after our impact. I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, what happens to the wilderness? The very idea, I mean, you might think, the very idea of a wilderness disappears because if it's untrammeled by man, and we're in an age in which it's official. It's our age. It's the age of our impact.
Makes you kind of proud, doesn't it?
Well, what do you think about that?
You know, I think it's an interesting idea. I mean, I think the customary practice among paleontologists and geologists is to name epochs after they've happened. And this one's sort of interesting, that scientists are naming what the epoch is before, in fact, we've seen what will happen. So I'm hopeful, if not, you know, a bit pessimistic at times about what we might be able to do.
But doesn't this idea of an epoch bring that there's really two questions here that kind of depend on scale? If you kind of step back and think, there's been a lot of these epochs, right? And a lot of biological creatures that were much more long-lived than we have been so far eventually died out after having tremendous impact. I mean, we're still getting oil from all the years the dinosaurs were on Earth, at least that's what I was told. So in the long run, we say man is part of nature, you know, that gets at the point. And like all other parts of nature, it will go, it will disappear, it will, you know, have little remainders on the world or in, you know, in completely unexpected ways, like maybe some future kind of biological species will get energy from our remains under the cities like we do with dinosaurs. And, you know, that's kind of not exactly cheerful, but it's realistic. Then the other thing is, but if you look at the scale, well, say, okay, but given that, the epoch that concerns us is the one we're involved in. And although our traces will wither away with time, during that epoch, they're going to be in there. So it's very important to think of ourselves as part of nature so we can rationally do something about the mess we're making.
Well, think of it this way. So, you know, of the great mass extinctions that have occurred, the one that's being projected by scientists actually is smaller in scope than the ones previous. So, to use your sort of optimism, the cautious
which
optimism.
Which is optimism right. With a funny twist.
But think about the extinction of the dinosaurs. From that came mammals, and from mammals, here we are, right? So there's maybe some...
See, but now people like Ken, who loves space travel, they really have this bifurcation. I mean, I'm sorry to criticize you here, Ken, but this bifurcation, you know, we're different. You know, we'll leave the world behind and have colonies on some godforsaken rock in the corner of nowhere. And that's a very confused idea, in my humble opinion.
Well, okay. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the nature of wilderness at Lewis and Clark College in front of a live and lively audience there. And we've got questions from that live and lively audience. Tell us who you are, where you're from, and what your question
is. My name's Todd Wilson, and I live in Portland. And, yeah, I have actually a few things that are kind of related, so I'll go through it, and then
I'll be concise.
Yeah,
you're going to be concise.
So the balance between exploiting the wilderness and nature and to enjoy it for things like ski areas and, you know, making trails into it, and the same time preserving it, because in order to preserve something, it has to have value, right? So there has to be a way for us to know it exists and enjoy it in order for us to attach a value to it so we know why we need to preserve it. And the other part of it is just, you know, preserving wilderness and having wilderness, it appeals to something different in different people, but it brings a lot of different kinds of people together. You know, I'm vegetarian, you know, I want to preserve the wilderness and, you know, be able to enjoy it but not necessarily exploit it. But I respect hunters and those that want to preserve it in the way that it is. So there will be, you know, animals left for them to hunt, you know, and to be able to enjoy in a different way.
So I wanted you to address something that I think is underlying this question. So to preserve wilderness, why? Because we value it. We want to exploit it. We want to enjoy it. We want to be awestruck by it. Not because it intrinsically deserves to be preserved. What do you think about that thought?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways to value things, and I think, you know, we can value things for instrumental reasons, right? They provide recreation and solitude, and traditionally wilderness has been thought of that way. It's a place for to get away from things, as it were. But on the other hand, sometimes we value things for their own sake, right? And I think wilderness and nature can be valued that way too.
But see, I think the idea that we value the instrumental valuing of wilderness because we want to enjoy it and all that, we want to get away. Look, I think that's a very sort of middle class, upper middle class thing. I mean, and I think wilderness has always been kind of owned by the elite. And indeed, I think that some people say that's one of the problems with the concept of wilderness. It's something that the elite who want to enjoy and exploit it throw on to this thing. What do you think of that thought? I don't want to accuse you of all those things, but you reminded me of this literature.
You look like the 1% to me, guy.
What do you think of that thought? There's a lot of cultural baggage, and it just came out associated with the concept of wilderness.
Well, I do agree that the concept of wilderness, the way it's pitched, is that it's untrammeled, unoccupied place. And I think the concept I mentioned a minute ago, wildness, the story we saw about New Orleans is the idea that places can become rewilded. I think that's a powerful idea. And I wouldn't want to use the notion of wilderness to make us think that nature's over there and there's the urban. Wildness is pervasive.
I mean, let me say a little bit of history. One of our great preservers is John Muir, and he was really upset when they took part of Yosemite National Park, the Hetch Hetchy, and made the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. And he said, why can't you just put that down, you know, around Stockton, you know, where nobody gives a diddle? Now, the area around Stockton is full of flora and fauna, you know, just as much as Yellowstone. So here's the idea of wilderness as preserving for biodiversity and things like that, and wilderness is preserving because it's awesome and fun for man. One quick story. I'm from Nebraska. There is no Prairie Lands National Park, probably never will be. I'll tell you why. Once my wife and I decided we were around Red Cloud, where Willa Cather was from, and I said, well, let's go look at where My Antonia, where that actually took place. And that's kind of been allowed to go back a little bit to the wild And so we got out of the car, our air-conditioned car, and it was hot, and then grasshoppers all over the place, you know? So one concept of wilderness, biodiversity, yes, Prairie Lands National Park. Another concept of wilderness, let's have fun hiking around in the awesome scenery. It's never going to happen.
No, John, I think you're onto something. This goes, again, this is part of the cultural baggage of the very concept of wilderness. It's sublime places, right? Sublime places that are awe-inspiring, that are like, you know, many ecologists, environmentalists are not religious, but there's this sublimity associated with the wilderness that's built into the... So the prairies, the plains, that's not wilderness because it's not sublime. But see, that doesn't really cut nature at some joint. I'm arguing against the concept of wilderness. But that doesn't... The concept of wilderness does not cut nature at any joint. And back to something John said in the beginning, it does lead us to reason badly about things because why should these sublime places be preserved and not these...
Let me see if I can put this thought that you're making, Ken, into my own words. John is right. I was wrong.
So what do you think?
So one of the great reasons for why we would have wilderness is it instills in us humility, right? We realize our proper place in the universe. One of the times where I realized my own sense of proper place was in Shanghai, seeing a wall of bikes coming my direction. I think the urban can do a lot of what wilderness can do. I don't think there's a principled sharp line.
Let's take some more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is James Spake. I'm from Portland, and I'm also an alum of the graduate school here. Going off the last question and what you just finished saying, the fact that we do have consciousness and can create myths as well as ignore them, what are the merits of promoting the value of wilderness as sacred and essential for all our flourishing?
So that makes the idea of a myth, wilderness, even though a myth, a useful, inspiring myth. What do you think about that? Even if it's false to the facts.
Right, right. Well, I think there's a lot of places in the world, and in fact in other nations, where there are religious sanctuaries set up just for that purpose. And I think, I'm not completely denigrating wilderness. I think it's a tool in a toolkit. It just has to be understood for very particular kinds of purposes.
If you ask about sacredness, I just say, or what we should worship, and I have to watch my words, I don't want to be struck dead. But it seems to me the natural thing for us to worship is that which is responsible for everything that's good and wonderful about our lives. And it's clear what that is. It's the earth. It's not some abstract God or numbers or that, I mean, maybe the Higgs boson, but I don't think we can do much good for the Higgs boson, but by worshiping the earth, we can do a lot of good. What's your question?
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen. My name's Samantha Barnes. I have grown up in a rainforest in southeast Alaska. I've had what you would call a rare experience having a relationship with nature. It's not a separate thing. It is something that I am a part of. And I would like to challenge you guys to consider that perhaps it's something that should not necessarily be protected as that thing that we go visit, that thing that is for our enjoyment. But that thing which nurtures us and sustains us, and it's so limited now. But I grew up around bears, fish, you know, hunted and foraged. Saw that a bear will react with the same feelings around borders, territorial borders, for instance, as a human might. And that when you see the relationship, the similarities, it encourages health in myself and in other humans. And that, perhaps we could think of nurturing ourselves as the same thing as nurturing nature.
Thank you. That's a deep thought.
I think you've raised some profound questions, and I really want to dig into them. This is a profound question you've raised. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the nature of wilderness with Jay Odenbaugh from Lewis and Clark College.
Let's be dry-eyed realists. Grounded in clear philosophy and accurate science. When we discuss wilderness, what should we focus on with respect to conservation, species extinction, global warming, and all the other ecological questions and issues that confront us?
We're coming to you from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. We'll take more questions from our live and very lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Tarzan came from Africa, had to go to school. Though he tried to learn our ways, he was beaten cruelly by bullies at the school. Tarzan called for Jane and boy, called for Simba too. All your clever chimpanzees, far away from you now, they cannot rescue you.
Let's hear it for our live musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about the nature of wilderness with Jay Odenbaugh from Lewis and Clark College. And I want to go back to Samantha's concerns, Jay. Look, you could think, here's something that some radical environmentalist ecologists think. I'm not sure how many, but I know people think this. Here's what we ought to do. We ought to roll back civilization. We ought to live in... There was a time when we lived in the wilderness. We evolved in the on the plains and moved all over, but, you know, and it didn't have all this pollution of civilization. We ought to roll back. And then we would live in much deeper harmony with the rest of the natural world. What do you think of that suggestion?
That's the message of Ishmael, the ecological ape, in a book whose name I forget.
What do you think of that? What do you think of that?
You know, I think it's a really interesting idea, but I think it's subject to a real deep problem, which is that if we are part of nature, the hunter-gatherer side of us is part of nature, but so are we now. And so the question is it possible for us to live a sustainable life in the 21st century that just looks different than the past?
The 21st century is way down this path. What we need to do is roll back to a different age. I mean, I read somewhere that some people think the first great human assault on the natural world was the invention of agriculture, and it's been all downhill since then. What do you think of that thought?
Well, I think agriculture is just one part of the transformations that have happened in the past. Like I mentioned, the Pleistocene overkill, getting rid of woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers, et cetera. There's a variety of those, but I think just because we are natural doesn't mean everything we do is good or bad. We have to ask, are the effects we're having now harmful or not? They have to be asked of each different sort of, you know, way we...
So I'm not sure what your response to me is. I want to know how we should live with respect to the rest of the natural world. I took Samantha to suggest we should live more in harmony with it. We should see it as the source of our being. And to actually live up to that, we would have to roll back a lot of our current industrial, urbanized...
Well, I mean, a lot is not the word if you're talking about going back to hunter-gatherer. I mean, in the first place, we would have to roll back the population to about half a billion at most, and we'd have to give up our iPads. I mean, I think agriculture isn't bad. Bean sprouts, I think, are pretty questionable.
Let's take another question from our live audience.
My name is David Burdick from Portland, Oregon. I'm a great wilderness adventurer, enjoyer of the wilderness, and also I enjoy community, infrastructure, city. My question is, it sounds like we're getting at the concept of living within Earth's carrying capacity. And if we were to reframe this discussion around that aspect, where now we actually are not trying to bring big cities in, but to trying to ensure that what we're doing and what our actions are within the ecosystem and within the services of the ecosystem so that they're not degrading. And I suspect that that's what we observe when we start to build up concepts like a wilderness, where we see that we've been outside of that ability to live within Earth's carrying capacity.
So look, I wanted you to address this, but I'm going to do something. I'm going to make you the world czar, the ecological environmental czar for 48 hours, and then you have to step down because we don't want a dictator. So how would we address this? How do we live? How do we go forward and live within, as you put it, the Earth's carrying capacity?
The first thing I know is I'd be a busy man for those 2 days, but there are a variety of things, very practical, you know, carbon tax, energy, funding, green energy, et cetera, ivy pulling. But one of the more, maybe as a philosopher, one of my more radical ideas is take a plot of land where there are no people, say 1,000 miles square. Remove all the roads, remove all of the maps, no satellites pass over, no planes. Why would we do that, right?
Yeah.
Well, because I think there's something really powerful in the idea that one way of thinking about the environment is to try to preserve and protect and save. But sometimes, by virtue of thinking only in that way, we forget to honor and respect. I think it would serve as a remarkable exercise of collective self-restraint as a species. Could we leave something aside and simply not know anything about it?
So you want us to kind of reconceive and reconfigure our relationship to the rest of the natural world, and that's you think that's an important step? I think you're right. Let's take some more questions. What, from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. I'm Stephen Manning from Portland, Oregon. And you've talked about the untrammeled space, the wild space, the wilderness space, the sublime space. My question is, how big does this space have to be? Is the Ninth Ward too small of a space to ever be considered wilderness?
That's a good question.
It's a great question. I think I just recently found out that U.S. Fish and Wildlife can... if your backyard or your garden meets certain kinds of criteria, it can actually be listed as wildlife habitat. The scale can be small.
Is there a tax break there?
I think so.
Yeah. The wildlife habitat, that sounds so pristine, and that sounds so clinical.
But
a wildlife habitat is not a wilderness.
Agreed. But one crucial concept that ecologists talk about is the notion of a metapopulation, the idea that what matters is that species are able to move from spot to spot.
Yeah. Let's take some more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Max Goins, and I'm from Lake Oswego, Oregon, and my question is for Mr. Perry. Are there any concepts that aren't confused? Because if there aren't, then we can't just, you know, throw them out like wilderness, because they'd all be confused.
You resent John's wanting to jettison the concept of wilderness.
On the basis of confusion, because it seems to me as a Derridean that, you know, concepts all have that sort of impurity.
Well, I have a theory I could go on about for some time, but I'll try to keep it short. I think there are natural concepts that evolve from the needs of humans doing fairly basic things. And those are mostly not confused, and they're not very detailed either. And then there's usually in tandem with each of those, like in tandem with the concept of freedom, which makes perfectly good sense. Is there some way I can do something that will bring that about? There's the concept of free will, which is kind of a theological agglomeration of confusion and wishful thinking. So I think that a lot of the job of philosophy is to kind of recover the sensible concepts, the working concepts, the concept with something to do. That's a very Wittgensteinian idea. From the accretions that religion and other philosophers than I have brought to them.
But to respond to the question, the spirit of the question, John was not against in his argument, and I don't think you're against. No, I'm not against preservation of something. But preservation under the idea of wilderness, which has all these cultural overlays that we've talked about, that's the problem. We need concepts that are better tools. The concept of a wilderness is not a good tool, is what we're saying. But that doesn't mean there aren't urgent things that we need to do. But let's take another question from our live audience.
Well, that actually leads really well into my question. I'm Chloe Waterman. I'm a student at Lewis and Clark College from Bloomington, Indiana. And my question is this. How do you think that we or environmental organizations, conservation organizations, could utilize an improved concept of wilderness, nature, or whatever you think is a useful concept to do a better job on a very practical level advocating for the environment?
You got an answer? You're nodding your head. You approve of the question, but what's the answer?
It's a deep question.
Yeah, it is a very deep question.
You know, we've talked about the notion of wilderness is either being confused or not, and I won't take a stand exactly on that now, but what I would say is there may be other concepts which actually do more work for us. So let me give you another one, the notion of biodiversity. So biodiversity is a notion that looks at the variation at all parts of nature. So variation with respect to genes and populations and species and ecosystems and landscapes. And I actually think the notion of biodiversity is compatible with our own existence. So even if we get rid of wilderness, there may be other concepts that can do the very practical things that you're talking about.
Lots of times a concept like wilderness, so a thing either is or isn't a wilderness, but really underlying it are a number of dimensions: wildness, untrammeledness, charmingness, spiritual enhancementness, promotion of biodiversityness. I'm not picking the world's most wonderful phrases for those things. But when you see that what you're getting at, the concerns you're getting with wilderness are really a bundle of related concerns, and a given place like the Desolation Wilderness or the prairie in Nebraska or Stockton or Hetch Hetchy can be high on some scales, not others. I think it can't help but improve the quality of thinking that's involved in trying to help things.
Nobody else come up to the mic, okay? We're way long, but we're going to take all the questions that we can get here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
My name is Justin Rock. I'm from Portland, Oregon. My question you've hinted towards, which is around being moral agents. And I'm curious if this bifurcation that you're talking about between humans and wilderness, if we get rid of that, but we are moral agents, what is our role as moral agents? Because I don't see dogs being moral agents, and I don't mean to offend people who, but we definitely have a different way of engaging with the world than most species and natural disasters. So I'm curious for you, what is the role? Is that our job because we are moral agents, or are we arrogant in thinking that we know what the path of nature is?
I think arrogance has gotten us here. I don't think we can escape it now. I think that we have to think about these problems anew. So let me just give you an example, one that I've thought a lot about, and that's imagine that you've got a species that, because of climate change, can't move because of temperature changing. What do we do about that? Do we let the species go extinct? Or there's a strategy ecologists are talking about now, assisted migration. What if we intentionally move the species? Now, here's the problem. Imagine that you move it outside its native range. You're thereby creating an invasive. So the problem is to save a species, you've got to create an exotic. If you don't want to create an exotic, you've got to let the species go extinct. So I think as agents, we're having to ask questions that we've never asked before.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, thank you. I teach American literature at a big blue-collar high school in Portland, and we're reading Into the Wild, A Kid Goes and Poisons Himself in Alaska. And of course, we read Emerson, who finds truth in nature. And I pose to my students, who are Chinese, Russian, Vietnamese, American-born, about what wildness means to them. And the kids who are born, mostly the Asian students or Russian students, are baffled by the question. They can't even approach it. The American kids engage it, and I wonder how much the concept of wilderness and wildness is a Western and American construct and what that means for a smaller, you know, globalized planet.
I think you're exactly right. I think it's a foreign concept if you live in a developing nation. And the reason being is that population density is just radically different than it is in the United States. And so many critics of the notion of wilderness think of it as a particular kind of environmentalism, an American-style environmentalism that can't be exported anywhere else.
And it's American environmentalism of a certain kind of American, those people who have never had to live and work the land. Because people who live and work the land and make their living and off the land, they say, of course the land is for pristine, untrammeled. That's not part of their way of thinking. Last question.
Hi. I was wondering, that you mentioned that we as humans are fundamentally different from nature as moral agents. And I'm wondering where you see this difference in... How would you judge nature as fundamentally harmonious or competitive and violent?
Both. So, you know, ecologists talk about the kinds of interactions that occur between species. Some are mutualistic, some are predator-prey, competitive, etc. And I think if this reconceptualization of our role in nature is to recognize, as natural beings, we are capable of mutualistic symbiotic relations, but it's something we have to work for.
Jay, this has been a fascinating and deep conversation. We could go on for a much longer, but we have to draw this to a close, and I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Jay Odenbaugh. He's a professor of philosophy at Lewis and Clark College. He's author of many articles in the philosophy of the biological sciences, including Advocacy, Ecology, and Environmental Ethics. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page, and you can follow our tweets on Twitter.
And there's more. You can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. You do that at our website, philosophytalk.org. And now, we speedwalk through the woods with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, do we even have wilderness anymore? We can take camping trips to Yosemite and lug espresso machines to the top of Mount Everest. These days, wilderness is more of a legal concept than anything. Our national parks have rules. You know, stay on the path, don't lean over the edge. A true wilderness doesn't have rules. Look at the Bible. God made the Israelites wander in the wilderness for 40 years. That's a long time to be lost. Nowadays, we just text the authorities on our cell phone and wait for the helicopter. On the other hand, John the Baptist was described as being a voice in the wilderness, which means there was nobody there to hear him. So which is it? Is he alone in the wilderness? Or are there scores of lost Israelites wandering around who just don't want to listen? The wilderness in the Bible is a weird place. It can be confusing and scary. It's where Jesus was tempted by Satan. It's also a place to get yourself sorted out. There's the story of Hagar, a slave to Abraham. His wife, Sarah, couldn't have kids, so she suggested he take up with Hagar. When Hagar got pregnant, she started getting snotty with Sarah, so Sarah bawled her out, and Hagar got so bummed out, she fled to the wilderness. And then an angel appeared unto her. See, the wilderness has angels, too. The angel told her that if she went back to Sarah and submitted to her, her descendants would be a multitude. So she went back, bore a son, Ishmael. Some years later, Sarah miraculously conceived, and her son, Isaac, was born. And the boys did not get along. Ishmael grew up to be wild, antisocial. Sarah didn't like Hagar and Ishmael and kept asking Abraham to get rid of them. He hesitated until God told him that though Isaac would be his true descendant, Ishmael would also have a nation. So Abraham sent them off. Whether this was before or after God telling Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, I don't know. Anyway, they went into the wilderness, and Ishmael became a skilled archer, married a woman from Egypt, and the Ishmaelites became the Arab peoples, while the Israelites became the Jews. And they still don't get along. The Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem is the third most holy place to Islam, a place where it is said the Prophet Muhammad first established Islam. But it's even more holy to the Jews. It's where Abraham almost killed Isaac, or maybe, as some believe, it was where he almost killed Ishmael. It's where the first temple of Solomon stood, and the second. It's highly contested ground between the descendants of the two sons of Abraham and their centuries-old quest to show who were the true sons of Abraham. You might even call the Dome of the Rock a kind of no-man's land, which is, I guess, another kind of wilderness, one we've been wandering in for thousands of years and no path in sight. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Devin Strolovich, the Playtones.
Special thanks to Becco Copenhaver, Michael Ford, Patrick Rial, and the Lewis and Clark Philosophy Department.
Thanks also to Joel Groves, Jason Rappaport, Caitlin Ash, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio for San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud corporate performance management and business analytics, offering products working to impact financial decisions for over a decade. More information at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Ty Rizdahl.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks. We talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you?
Hey, Kai. I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. You know, getting by.
Yep. So the new college football season is upon us
it
now.
Is.
It's always
it
exciting.
Is.
The, you know, just unbelievable sheer athleticism. You see the marching
yep.
bands and,
yep.
and the freshmen barfing all over the
okay,
stadium.
Okay, wait, what? Because that's not
yeah.
what I was expecting.
Yeah, no, that's so that's what I want to talk to you about today. Let me start with Oliver Luck. He is
yes.
the athletic director at West Virginia University. That's what he got used to seeing at football games there.
Ew.
People drinking far too much at pregame parties, tailgate parties before games, sneaking alcohol into games, leaving at halftime to drink even more and come back into the game.
Now, Oliver Luck happens to be the father of quarterback Andrew Luck, who is
oh.
this year's number one NFL draft
yes,
pick.
Yes, he was.
New QB for the Indianapolis Colts.
Got that right.
Oliver
Big
Luck,
shoes to
the
fill.
Papa. That's right. Yep. The Papa was an NFL quarterback himself for a few years.
Okay.
And now, as a college athletic director, he learned that most colleges, in keeping with their academic mission, do not sell alcohol at football games.
I didn't
but,
know that.
Not surprisingly, that doesn't stop everybody, including students, from drinking, especially because some schools, West Virginia among them, they have what's called a pass-out policy.
A now, what?
Yes, you heard me right, but you're thinking differently.
I am, that's right.
This does not have anything to do with passing out from drinking too much.
Right.
It has to do with the fact that you are allowed to pass out of the stadium and back in during the game, which means
okay.
you can go out and drink.
This whole thing is not shocking, right? That's the point.
It is not, but that doesn't mean you have to be happy about it or even tolerate
sure.
it. So Oliver Luck last year proposed that two things. One, that West Virginia get rid of that pass-out policy and that it try something different inside the stadium.
Okay.
So, you know, I began to think a little bit, you know, sort of counterintuitively that actually selling beer at our stadium would actually help us gain control.
So here's where I need you to explain the counterintuitive thing, right? Because how does it – I mean, you get some money from the beer sales, but how does it help you control the problem if you're
right.
actually
okay.
selling
so,
the
right.
beverage?
Right, okay. So let's do the money first. West Virginia right. did clear about $500,000 from beer sales that first
which
year.
Is,
projected
nice.
It'll probably
yeah.
double this year, right? That's
wow.
nice.
That's a lot of beer.
But you're right. Now that you're selling beer in the stadium, you might think you're going to have more alcohol trouble, more
yeah.
arrests for underage drinking, more violence. And that is what the campus police at West Virginia last year, in the first year, were prepared for. But that is not what happened. Here's Police Chief Bob Roberts.
Yeah, in 2010, we made 117 arrests on game days. And in this past year, we only made 79.
Hmm.
See, that's almost, well, that's 35% reduction in arrest we made.
Which is good. So is what's his name, Luck, trying to sell this to other schools? I mean, get them to try it?
I wouldn't say he's an evangelist quite, but when they come, when they see what's happening there and they come for help, he gives it. The University of Minnesota, for instance, wanted to try selling beer in the stadium. It had to get, however, support from the state legislature first, and Luck did talk to some legislative aides along the way. And now, as a result, this fall, Minnesota will be starting a 2-year trial of beer sales.
Yeah, which totally makes sense, right? You can drink 50 feet outside the stadium gates, but you can't inside, right? Come on.
Exactly. I mean, look, this is complicated, and you don't want to make light of it. Alcohol abuse is a very major problem on college campuses and elsewhere, and the idea of making more alcohol available in more places may strike some people as ridiculous. But what I like about this approach is that instead of, you know, when you've got a problem, you can stick your head in the sand or you can acknowledge the problem exists and try to come up with a new kind of solution. And that, I think, is what we're talking about here. Listen again, Kai, to West Virginia University Police Chief Bob Roberts.
Okay.
You know, you might as well face reality and try to control it and at least keep the environment as safe as you can.
How's that for a motto, Kai? Controlling reality one day at a time. I like that, huh?
That's right. Stephen Dubner, he tries to do that every day of his life. Freakonomics.com is the website. He is back in a couple of weeks. See you, man.
Thanks so much, Kai. In our next podcast, we look at what happens to your rational self when you put on a mask.
A middle-aged lady came and apologized to me afterwards and said, "I'm so sorry, I put the mask on and I found myself being very rude. I was getting too close to the performers. I even touched one at one point. I'm so sorry."
We go behind the scenes of Sleep No More, a fantastically interesting piece of immersion theater.
I got a little rude with people. I was kind of like, get the hell out of the way, man.
I would not have usually blindly gone into dark corridors, because I'm usually scared of everything.
We'll also hear from the man who created the infamous Stanford Prison
Taylor, WHFR 0.1.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. But it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of vets who've got your back. Whether it's managing the transition home or everyday stuff
like finding a nice sweater for my dog.
Sweater? Really?
Okay, maybe not. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
You are now listening to WHFR. 89.3 FM on your radio dial. I am the Diva. And my show, Lyrical Infusion, is on every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Join me as I serve up some mental musical gumbo for your moody Monday play.